This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasoli. We're discussing the need for a 24-hour heart center. The purpose of the heart, you know, is to pump blood to the rest of the body. And when this function is suddenly blocked, we call it a heart attack. So emergency physician Dr. Farina Mohammad Saleh from Institute Jantung Negara in the studio with us to help us understand the need to seek treatment almost immediately when a heart attack actually happens. Welcome to the show, Dr. Farina. How are you today?
Thank you, Miriam. I'm fine, thanks.
Who gets a heart attack usually? I mean, you see tons of people coming through your door. Who are these people?
Well, we talk about risk factors, so people with risk factors will usually come with a heart attack. But nowadays, you know, it's something that's really common. I think for the last few years or almost every year, the top 10 causes of death, you'll have a heart attack in the top 10 causes of death in Malaysia. So we're talking about anyone with diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol problems, smoking, and so on and so forth. And the thing about Malaysia is that the age at which people present with a heart attack gets younger and younger. It's quite common for us to see people in their 40s getting a heart attack nowadays.
And do we know the reason for that? Is it because of, you know, undiagnosed hypertension or undiagnosed diabetes or, you know, what's happening?
Well, compared to America, in America, you think like the disease of the heart or a heart attack would happen in people much older, someone in their 70s, someone in their 60s. In Malaysia, the average has been 58, an age of 58 for a heart attack. And we are mostly looking at lifestyle. So if you've read the papers, I think there has been an article out recently on the rate of obesity in Malaysia. We are pretty high up on the list, especially in Southeast Asia. And I think that's a combination of diet and also poor living habits like lack of exercise, too much stress, smoking, and so on and so forth.
America aside, how are we doing in the region? Because I would think, you know, we are one of those developing countries and there are a lot of those countries around us. Are they also going through the same thing or is it just unique to us?
I think because of the obesity, I think we are the ones looking at a younger population. We've seen people in their 30s. We've seen people in their 20s having a heart attack. I'm not entirely sure about regionally, but this is the trend that we've been seeing in Malaysia.
Okay, what about between the men and women? Changing demographic in that sense?
Okay, so predominantly men, okay, and but we do see women as well. And the thing about women peculiarly is that we present in a different manner to men. So in men, you're talking about chest pain on the left side of the chest, sweating and so on and so forth. But in women, we talk more about atypical chest pain on the right side of the chest, or pain in the shoulders. And also it's how we perceive pain. I know it's a very popular thought that women sort of either seek treatment later, they sort of handle the pain a bit better. Mm-hmm. So they might come later, you know, and from that you might get certain complications if you present later, as you mentioned earlier, that you have a heart attack, you need to come and seek treatment as soon as possible.
Possible, okay. And I assume also women seem to have, it's a perception, I don't know, that we have a higher threshold for pain. And so we just dismiss it as something else, isn't
it?
And the men, we just quickly want to go through the symptoms for men.
Okay. So generally the symptoms would be chest pain. Okay. And with that, you could have profuse sweating, breathing difficulties. You could have palpitations whereby you feel that your heartbeat is getting faster and you're more aware of your heartbeat. Or the worst case scenario is collapsing or losing a life because of a massive heart attack. And therein lies the importance of knowing what to do in such situations.
Dr. Farina, are there misconceptions about the pain or the symptoms when you're having a heart attack?
Yes, we had a specialist who was working in the emergency department during fasting month, and he had sort of vague pains in the upper abdomen area where people usually describe as a gastric pain. And he was working at that point in time, and he attributed it to fasting. So he had a drink, and he was even sweating at that time, you know. And he let this go on for about 2 hours before he really thought, oh, I might be having a heart attack. Subsequently to that, he did an ECG and found that he did have a heart attack, and he was sent over to us in IJN for treatment. This goes to show that people perceive pain very differently. If you have a worrying feeling, go have it checked out at the appropriate place, like a hospital. Don't worry if you over-suspect yourself. We are used to that. A simple ECG would tell you the difference. And better to have it checked out rather than delay the treatment that you need.
Any other misconceptions as far as heart attacks are concerned?
As I mentioned, women. Women have different types of pain. They seek treatment later. They sort of, you know, I'm going to wait for my husband to come home to take me to the hospital. Oh, this is nothing. Until it gets really bad before they start to seek treatment.
What about an anxiety attack? Are those symptoms very similar? Because I do know people who rush to the hospital only to find that they've just had an anxiety attack. It's not a heart attack.
Yeah. I've seen several patients that way. But we can distinguish between the two. And it's a matter of doing actually an ECG or an electrocardiogram. And also a simple blood test would differentiate between the two. And even the history, although similar, we are still able to differentiate between them.
Okay, you're the expert, really. So what happens when you have a heart attack? Can you just describe it? What's happening inside?
All right, so I noticed that in the introduction, you explained it quite well. So you have several blood vessels to your heart, which are called the main blood vessels. And if for some reason this blood vessel gets blocked, the heart muscle sort of goes through a period where it gets lack of oxygen. And after a few hours, the muscle cell dies. And this is what you call a full-on heart attack. You could have like a smaller heart attack if this occurs at blood vessels that are smaller, whereby there will be changes in the ECG and also in the bloods.
So that's how you know. I mean, you know that we're actually having a heart attack.
Yes.
So we know what causes a heart attack, but why is it so important to actually get help immediately? And we know about strokes and how you have that window of roughly 2 hours because that helps minimize. But what about a heart attack?
Okay, so if you're talking about a blockage in the artery, the mainstay of the treatment is to relieve this blockage. And this is done by several methods. So obviously, the reason why we want to get to this blockage early is because the longer the heart doesn't get the oxygen, the area that is involved where the cell dies gets larger, or it could be irreversible and lead to complications that you can't really do much about if you get to the heart attack late. So with the mainstay of sort of diluting or getting rid of this blood clot, there are several ways to treat it. One is by medication, and another one is a procedure, okay, which is called primary percutaneous coronary intervention, or a primary PCI. Okay,
we know it as ballooning or stenting.
Yeah, ballooning, okay.
Or just sticking a stent.
You know, we sometimes ask, okay, do you have a spring in your artery? Like, you know, there are different words that we use that people understand better.
Yes, so a ballooning or stent. Just one step back. You said the heart experiences cell death. So what? If we experience cell death all the time, what's going on in there?
All right, so just like having a scar. So a scar on your skin. So you can imagine that there's a certain area of your heart that previously functioned to pump blood all throughout your body is now a scar tissue. So it's a non-functioning, it's not pumping, it's not conducting the electrical impulses as it should. So you're talking about losing function of the heart. In terms of long-term complications, you get heart failure where the heart doesn't pump properly. You get fluid accumulation in your lungs and a lot of other complications.
Okay, so you want to know, what are you going to go in and do? With this ballooning and stenting, what's going to happen?
Okay, so I mentioned two methods. One is giving drugs that would sort of dissolve the clot. Okay, and the other one, if you can imagine, that would be something indirect. You can't see the clot being dissolved. But when you're talking about ballooning, you're talking about something that you can see. When you do the angiogram, you're able to see the percentage of blockage that is occurring, exactly which vessel is involved. You're going to target that vessel and you're going to balloon it and physically cause blood to reflow back into the artery. And so that you reduce the chances of that part of the heart having cell death.
And when do you know that you can actually prescribe medication and it's going to work for this patient as opposed to doing a ballooning or stenting?
Okay. At some point, it is a cost issue because there's obviously a cost difference between the two. I would say that all centres would have the medication. Not all centres would have ballooning facility. So IGN is one of the few centres in the Klang Valley that provides this service 24/7. And to have this service 24/7, you're talking about having a cardiologist on call around the clock who is able to open the catheterization lab in a short span of time and to perform this procedure as soon as possible. The target for this is about 90 minutes for an international standard from the time the patient arrives until the ballooning is done. In IGN, we've managed to do this in about 45 minutes. And
wow.
Yeah.
From the time you come in.
And I'll tell you a story about what has happened in the past. So at the end of 2014, next to IGN is Hospital Kuala Lumpur, is the general hospital, and they receive a lot of patients with heart attacks. And because it is a government hospital, it is traditionally seen that for this procedure, they are sent to Hospital Serdang, which is about half an hour away. So the powers that be thought that this was unacceptable. You have IGN next door. So what we did was an initial network between these two hospitals where their heart attack patients are sent to IGN and then the procedure is done in IGN. Okay. What this led to was we had monthly meetings to reduce the time of travel, to reduce the processes, to reduce any repetitions so that the patient would get the treatment as soon as possible. So because of this improvement in procedure, it actually improved every other procedure that we did. That means if someone comes to our door, the time from emergency department to the time the ballooning is done has also been reduced significantly in the last few years because of this process. Right now, we work like clockwork. We receive the patient and we are even very much ready within a few minutes to do the procedure.
Fantastic. So we'll come back and find out, how CPR is important. I mean, before we even get to the hospital, why that's important. And I also want to know, you did say it's a question of cost between deciding on medication versus ballooning or stenting. But in my mind, if I can avoid even ballooning and stenting, I'd rather go with the medication option. But why is it then, the whole idea of ballooning and stenting sort of trumps the need for medication? Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment, Dr. Farina Mohammad Saleh, emergency physician from Institute Jantung Negara, we are discussing IGN's 24-hour heart center. I mean, it's amazing that your sort of turnaround time from the time a person comes into emergency to the time they actually get their ballooning and stenting done, if you've had a heart attack, has moved from 1.5 hours to just 45 minutes. Now, what are the benefits of doing this in a much shorter period of time? How does the patient benefit from that?
Okay. As you mentioned, the lack of oxygen, the time where the muscle is without oxygen. What we want to do is we want to prevent the area of involvement.
Heart muscles lacking oxygen.
Yes. Okay. So the longer the heart muscle doesn't get oxygen, the longer it suffers. Okay, and as I mentioned before about the cell death. So we're working with a small window of opportunity, actually.
Okay, so the more heart muscles that get damaged, what happens to the heart?
It doesn't function well. And you're talking about irreversible damage. Once the cell has died, you can't really get the cell alive again. You're just left with scar tissue.
How does that impair how we live after?
Ah, I see. So this is the thing. We're talking about a disease of now affecting people who are younger, right? And you're talking about someone who has a lot of years ahead of him. So if he has a lot of years ahead of him, if you're talking about someone in their 30s or in their 40s who have young children, who have a job to go to, who has a family to support, you want to reduce these complications because you're talking about someone who has a lot of potential in their lives.
Okay, so, but then what happens? You can live.
You can live.
But how does that affect you?
You are dependent on a lot of medication, so that's an increased cost to a person. You are dependent on support, depending on whatever complications you had. You might have other complications which require even more expensive interventions, such as a pacemaker. So we're talking about cost and overall lifetime of cost and quality of living for the person.
Because the heart is now not functioning at full capacity.
Yes.
Earlier on, we spoke about medication and the need for ballooning and stenting.
Yes.
As I mentioned, if I had the option, I'd go with the medication. What's the difference?
Okay. It sounds a lot less scary when you're talking about medication, right? Basically, you're giving something that dilutes the blood. So there are complications associated with it, such as bleeding, okay? Whether you bleed in a not so dire manner or if you have catastrophic bleeding in the brain. So that's the two ends of spectrum.
So it's a blood thinner.
Yeah, it's a blood thinner.
Okay.
Because your purpose is to dissolve the clot, right? The rate of success of both is obviously different. There is some failure rate in giving the medication as well. So there are some people who receive the medication but ultimately do need the ballooning as well. All right. And patients who do have good response to the treatment will also later need some sort of angiogram to look at the blockages of the heart again. So, you know, if I were to choose one or the other, I would choose one that gives the best output. You're looking at something that's direct. So they are directly either pulling the clot out and also ballooning the blood vessel so that it becomes bigger. And you can actually see the improvement. So between something that is not so direct, may have failure rates, I would choose, obviously, the superior one of the other.
Okay. This may sound terribly ignorant, but you are talking about a blood clot.
Yes.
And my understanding of how a heart attack happens is when you have plaque and it blocks your blood vessel. What's the difference between having a blood clot and plaque?
That's actually a very good question.
Because
do not worry about that.
Okay.
All right. So maybe I'll backtrack to the heart attack itself.
Okay.
So when you have diabetes and you have cholesterol and you have high blood pressure, you are prone to have plaques or narrowing of your blood vessel. Okay. So let's say this plaque narrows your blood vessel to about 50% of its usual diameter. What could happen acutely is that, or suddenly, is that plaque ruptures because of your high blood pressure, because the plaque has a thin wall. And what happens at that plaque site is the blood clot.
I see.
Ah.
Okay. Well, then we always use this word blockages very loosely. I always imagine the plaque just filling up the whole blood vessel and blocking it. And
correct.
So that stops the flow of blood.
Yeah.
And then the blood clot comes about.
Yes.
Okay. The need for CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. People have heart attacks all over the place, in restaurants, you know, the places that you least expect it. What do we do immediately? I mean, if we're around, what do you do? And not, you know, in Malaysians, not all of us are have actually gone for a CPR course. So we really don't know what to do.
Okay. Actually, this is a topic that's very close to my heart. It's been something that I've been doing since I was since I started off as a junior doctor, and it is actually public awareness of doing CPR. All right. So I can't stress the importance of doing this because it is something that anyone can do, and I've taught students as young as those in primary school in a community, and that means that anyone can really do it. As we said earlier, when it concerns the heart, you need to do something immediately, right? So when the patient collapses, let's say the heart stops working at that point in time. So now there is no blood pumping throughout your body. So what CPR does essentially is try to mimic the function of the heart. You know, that's when they do the chest compressions. What they're trying to do is to push the blood out of the heart and try to circulate it manually throughout the body. So once, let's say, a patient drops to the ground and there is no breathing, we assume at that point that the heart is not working as well. And at that point in time, get help call an ambulance and start to do chest compressions. The beauty of this is that in the latest guidelines, and we usually go by this American Heart Association guidelines, since 2010, they've actually advocated that if you are a bystander, you can do chest compression only CPR without the mouth-to-mouth. Okay, this is assuming that if the patient collapsed right in front of you, there is still oxygen within the lungs, and therefore all you need to do is to compress so that this oxygenated blood goes throughout the lung. If I may relate a small story.
Go ahead.
I think when these guidelines just came out in 2010, and I was at a pool party of my son's school friend, and a boy was pulled out of the pool and he was lifeless. He was blue. And at that time, the guidelines just came out. I wasn't keen to do mouth-to-mouth because the mouth was full of water. Mm-hmm. So even in that setting, I was a new specialist at that time, it was very difficult to remember much when you're in that situation. So I just remembered chest compressions. And that's what I did for the child. I did it for about 2 minutes, and he started coughing, and he started breathing, and he started talking. And I did not think that anyone at that point realized the gravity of it, because he actually started talking after that. But I knew that had I not been there, I really do not know whether people would have known to do the right thing. He was in hospital for a week and then back to school after that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I immediately told my colleagues, like, look, this works. We just have to do chest compression, you know. There was no mouth-to-mouth necessary at that point.
Do you think that people are reluctant to do CPR because of the mouth-to-mouth now?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, we're in a society where there's a lot of infectious diseases going around.
Yes.
It is on the increase. And I would be very reluctant to do it on someone that I have no history with. Perhaps if someone was my relative, I wouldn't mind. But definitely if someone I do not know, it's a stranger by the roadside. But I definitely wouldn't mind doing chest compressions. So it's something that anyone can do. You can do it immediately while someone calls for help. Definitely if you have an opportunity to learn to do CPR from somewhere.
What was the importance of mouth-to-mouth anyway?
Okay.
Obviously, there was a reason we did that.
Yeah.
In the past.
So the good thing about the American Heart Association was that they based their recommendation on studies that is done throughout the world. So they analyze what is the evidence. And every year there is recommendations, and they make these recommendations every 5 years. So it's evidence-based. So at that point, they realized the need for the bystander to perform chest compression immediately and effectively on the patient. And they found that at that point, mouth-to-mouth, if not given, still gave a chance of survival for the patient.
Okay. What if, and then there's this fear that you would do CPR all wrong, chest compressions all wrong, and that, you know, you might make the situation worse. What do you say to that?
You may cause damage, but I'm thinking you, right in front of you, is someone without a pulse. How much more damage could you do than someone without a pulse? Than
break
someone,
a couple of ribs, perhaps?
Yes, it's a known complication.
But it's okay?
Ideally, you want to have some sort of training, but I'd say that do something rather than do nothing. Because when you do something, you give a bit of a chance to the patient. If you do nothing, you are giving no chance.
What are some of the common mistakes, or what do we need to bear in mind so we don't cause those problems?
Okay. The location where you do chest compression. Okay, you have a bone right in front. Basically, you just need to go to the center of that. And you compress
the
there.
Sternum?
The sternum, yes.
Center of the sternum?
Center of the sternum. And compression-wise, people say, according to the guidelines, you'll be at least 2 inches deep. So if you think about it, it's not that easy to think about, am I pressing 2 inches, right?
2 inches is a lot for me.
Yeah, it's true. You get tired after 2 minutes. You get tired after 2 minutes. And more often than not, people do it shallow rather than too deep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you're talking about complications, if you're alone, it's less likely because you are going to tire out from doing the chest compressions.
Okay. What about aspirin? Should a bystander give a patient an aspirin, perhaps?
Okay. I like this question very much.
It's a blood thinner, right?
Yeah, it's a blood thinner. So for heart attacks, one of the early things or medication that we give is aspirin. But you know that if you're watching TV and there's always Western stories, they keep aspirin like we keep Panadol, right? So their aspirin is equivalent to our Panadol. So we keep a lot of Panadol and it doesn't really help in a heart attack. It is actually aspirin. So if you do have aspirin, yes, there is the medication.
So chances are we're not.
Yes, chances are we don't have aspirin at home.
Okay. All right. Some companies have been advised to have defibrillators in organizations. Now, companies seem to be reluctant to actually invest in these things. They're becoming more affordable, but how important are those defibrillators, for an example?
Okay. If you imagine when someone does an ECG, there's a rhythm to the heart. There's an electrical sort of component to the heart, right? And when you die, it is a flat line. Okay, so from getting from that rhythm component to the flat line, there is an in-between where the heart may fibrillate or go out of rhythm. Okay, this is the only time where actually a defibrillator is indicated. And that is why the defibrillator needs to be in the community because you get this in-between rhythm when the patient just collapses, all right? So by the time the ambulance gets to you, most likely it's already a flat line, mm-hmm. Okay? So that is the importance why this defibrillator, or we call it an AED or an automated external defibrillator for community use. In our CPR courses and most CPR courses, this is taught to the public because the AED is an automated equipment. That means it will actually prompt you what to do.
The one from the community.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. It's a simple equipment. We even keep it at the hospital as well. It actually is just two pads that you stick to the chest. It reads the rhythm of the heart. It will tell you if a defibrillation is required.
Okay.
Because if you flatline, then it will just say, okay, just do CPR.
I see. Okay. And it's just to defibrillate, is it just you press a button?
Yeah, you press a button. It says, okay, the machine is charging. And then when the machine is fully charged, it delivers about 200 joules. And the machine says, okay, press the red button. Okay, so of course, obviously you have to stand clear away from the patient. And then you press the button and it will deliver a shock. And then it will prompt you, okay, now do CPR.
I see. Okay. And if you're wondering what a defibrillator is, well, you've watched it in all the hospital programs. It's when they put these two things on your chest and then they shock you and then the patient sort of goes into some kind of a shock as we watch it. And these are community defibrillators, which would you recommend organizations to have them or at least in a building to have one or two defibrillators?
Yeah, definitely.
And we have tons of commercial buildings in this country.
Yep. Obviously, there's no law to it.
Do you think it should be a law?
I wish it would be. Mm-hmm. I know that there needs to be awareness. In Japan, I think, I'm not sure exactly who, but it was someone very important who had a heart attack. And since then, they advocated having defibrillators in a lot of public places. I've been up the Eiffel Tower, right on top of the Eiffel Tower. I saw a defibrillator. A lot of airports actually have defibrillators at certain distances.
They're on the wall, aren't they?
They're on the wall. Mm-hmm. I think they have it in KLIA as well. So when I go to public places, I actually look around for these things.
You would look for it. We won't. So we need to know where it is. The next time you're walking around, just have a look. See if you can actually identify it. And at least you are aware. It would save lives, don't you think?
Yes. We call this thing a chain of survival. The chain of survival consists of getting early access. That means getting help early. So calling an ambulance early, giving CPR early, defibrillation if required early, and of course, getting the person to the hospital for advanced treatment early. So this is a chain of survival.
Okay, so when a patient arrives at IJN they think they have a heart attack, what happens from there?
Okay, so I must stress going to the right place. And one of the great mimickers of heart attack is gastric pain.
Angin.
A lot of people go to the clinic, which may not have an ECG machine. They end up getting treated as gastritis and sent home. And this is quite common. So the right place to go if you feel those symptoms is actually a hospital where an ECG can be done. And every hospital has this. You know, when you say you have chest pain, they will get you to an ECG machine as soon as possible. You definitely jump queue to have an ECG done. Okay. If you call for an ambulance and you say you have chest pain, you are also high on the priority list compared to if you have pain in your leg, So there's always high priority for people with chest pain. So once you get to the hospital, you'll get an ECG done, and this will be evaluated by your doctor. If we find that you're having a heart attack, you will be prepared to be sent to the catheterization lab for the ballooning, as per what we discussed earlier, a target. Okay, and that's basically it, you know.
And then you come out and recovery after?
Yeah, you come out and have a recovery. If everything goes well, the procedure, if not too complicated, may take less than an hour. You're talking about perhaps half an hour as well, because they do want to work fast to relieve the clot that is causing the heart attack.
And do you get to go home after, or do you stay?
A couple of days.
Okay, for monitoring and all
yes,
of that.
Yeah.
What are long-term results like for, say, the younger people?
So if you're talking about solving some, you're solving the problem early. So you're reducing a rate of complication. You're reducing the cell death. You're reducing the area that is affected. So you're talking about also minimizing the long-term complications. Okay, and of course, that has a cost benefit not only to the person, but also to the country as well.
And so survival rate, would you say, from ballooning and stenting?
In general,
what does it depend on?
It depends on a successful procedure. There are times where they do the angiogram and they find that the vessels are too severe and they are not able to proceed. The next step would be surgery.
A heart bypass.
Yeah.
Okay. Your advice to prevent a heart attack?
Exercise. Live a healthy lifestyle. The food is really good in Malaysia and that contributes to the obesity. But my father used to tell me, taste only goes from your tongue to your throat and that's it. All right. So he says, I don't mind tasting, but he will limit the quantity that he takes. Eat a lot of healthy food, maintain a healthy lifestyle. Smoking is a big no-no. You know, the most of the patients who come that are young are smokers, unfortunately. About 38% of people with heart attacks are smokers. And I think we all know who smokers are. And you know, we know a lot of people who smoke. It's such a bad habit. And we start young, you know, in high school. And we continue throughout our lives, you know. It's just a bad lifestyle.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Farina Mohamad Saleh, an emergency physician from Institut Jantung Negara, speaking to us about the 24-hour heart center at IGN and, you know, the need for quick response when somebody's actually going through or having a heart attack. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.